Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, this is George Lynch, and you are listening to Talking Metal.
All right, guys, it is August 5th, 2 days late. Sorry, we always post these episodes on Tuesdays, but today is a Thursday. The cool news is the interview that is in today's show was literally recorded today at 12:30 Eastern Standard Time. Actually, George was a little late calling in, so it was more like 12:40. We got a full 20 minutes with him. I probably only got through about half of my questions, but I think we got some good conversation out of George, not only about his new album, which is called Seamless. It's an instrumental guitar record, which is quite good, but also about his new band, The Electric Freedom. We talk COVID, we talk the Delta variant, and should bands be out there playing right now? We get into that too, so stay tuned for that with George Lynch, one of my favorite guitar players of all time. I sincerely mean that. He truly is. All right, and so without further ado, let's thank the people who make this show happen. We've lost a few, which bums me out. We're trying to move forward, not backwards. So if you are available, if you're in a position where you really like this show a lot and you can afford $2 a month, please join us by pledging $2 a month on Patreon. Of course, you will get a bonus podcast every week. If you want to do $5 a month, I will mail you out a t-shirt. And we have a new patron this week. Although we lost a few, we did gain one. His name is Steph, or her name. I'm not really sure. But Steph, thanks so much for your support here on Patreon, on Talking Metal. Yes, let's do this. We're going to thank each and every one of you guys who are supporting me on Patreon. First, a big shout out to those people who have been supporting us for a very long time. Metal Dan, since July 2017. Wow, thank you, Dan. That's awesome. John Buavari, also since July 2017. You rock, John. Thank you so much. Steve Hoker, since October 2017. Mike Jones, since November 2017. Michael Street, since January 2018. Fred Rutz, since February 1st, 2018. You guys have been with me for quite some time, and I do appreciate all the support. Also, guys like David Gray, James Bennett, Anthony Mackey, Jean-Francois Blah, Ron Keel. Yeah, that Ron Keel. You guys have been with me a long time, too. So I really appreciate all the support that you guys have given me for such a long period of time. And check out Ron Keel's Patreon. He is one of my favorite metal singers. He obviously sings other genres of music too, which I've teased him about in the past, but I respect everything the guy does. He's a great talent, from Steeler to the Ron Keel Band to Ronnie Lee Keel. It's all good. Check out Ron Keel on Patreon. Big thanks to Steven Saylor for your support, Steven. I really appreciate that. Jason Seth, Joe Ryan, Matt Carroll, Drake, Sam Soupy, Jerry from Long Island, my main man that helps me with the podcasts on Patreon, Victor M. Ruiz. He also supports me on Patreon. Dan Gurwan, Brad Dahl, Leo Shabin from Alaska, aka Leo from Alaska, Kenny McCrimmon, Gregory Muse, Tommy Anderson, Steven Rodriguez, Johan Erdestrom, Chris Riley, Jeremy Weltman, Andrew Miller, Mario Schrantz, Sean Richmond, Gene Eugene DX, who's been supporting me since December, and when he first started supporting, he didn't want a t-shirt, but I guess he changed his mind. I just mailed that out to you. Gene Eugene DX, the medium t-shirt is on the way to you in Canada. Victor Guzman, Blue Walsh 21, Jerry from Salt Lake City, Patrick Sabin, Denny Striegel, Ed Ferguson, James Barron, Huckney Jacobson, John Simpson, who I was just texting with today, Henry Reeves, a.k.a. That Henry Reeves, Hank Reeves, who heads up Dash Vodka. Check out dashvodka.com. Alan Janssen, Seth B., Madison Hatter, Dane Damage, Adrian Kuzik, Kato Yogova, Sam Warwick, and of course we mentioned this person earlier, Steph, who just joined me this month. Now, a couple of you guys, it appears that your credit card went bad. So if you want to check that, like Davin Guttner, I just mailed you a t-shirt. I'm hoping we can get your credit card corrected since you only just joined us, Davin. It actually, your first month did not go through. So hopefully you can tweak that credit card. I did just mail your t-shirt out today. Joe Van Cherry, something wrong with his credit card too, I'm not sure. Jonathan Turner and Ralph Petrie, all having issues with their credit cards. So, yeah. All right, let's get into the show right now. Hey, it's Mark Striegel. Thank you for joining us here on the Talking Metal Podcast. Today's guest is George Lynch. I want to get right into this interview because it is a good one, and George has just a great new record out. It is called Seamless by George Lynch. It's actually not out yet. It is out August 20th in about 15 days from now. So definitely check it out. But before we do, I did want to mention a headline that kind of caught my eye. I don't know if this is revisionist history or not, but Wendy Dio has said that, you know, there was no bad blood or there was no negativity between Ronnie James Dio and Ozzy Osbourne. And I don't know, having grown up through that era, I'm feeling that maybe this is slightly revisionist history and slightly not. And I'll tell you why, because I do think the press played it up. But I do believe there were some actual quotes from the Ozzy camp, possibly even Ozzy, where they kind of didn't like Dio. And I mean, I get it. Dio replaced Ozzy and Sabbath. You know, it is interesting because I do remember, if you remember the little person, midget, I guess is what we used to call him, the little person that was touring on the Diary of a Madman tour, were referring to him as Ronnie, kind of poking fun that he was short like Ronnie James Dio, the guy who replaced Ozzy and Sabbath. I don't know if that's true. I remember reading that in a newspaper or magazine article when I was on my honeymoon like 16 years ago. I specifically remember that because I'd never heard that as a kid, you know. But I do remember reading that. I had this like European imported magazine on Ozzy and Sabbath. And so I don't know if that's true, but what I will tell you is true. And this is kind of interesting. A couple things. Keep the little person named Ronnie in mind for just a minute. But when Rudy Sarzo was on my podcast just recently on this podcast, Talking Metal, I asked him, listen, was there bad blood between Ozzy and Dio? And he said, no, he never heard Ozzy talk bad about Dio. And he never heard Dio talk bad about Ozzy. I think that's what he said. And he said he did hear Ozzy talk bad about Iommi, but not Dio. And he actually said that Dio wrote the song, The King of Rock and Roll, which I've re-listened to a lot lately, and it sounds like a positive song. There's no really negativity to the lyrics or anything. He said that song was written about Ozzy Osbourne. I never heard that stated anywhere else, except when Rudy Sarzo, who just joined Quiet Riot, by the way, said that. So, interesting. And so, now here's the thing. Ian Gillan, in his book, specifically said that when he toured with Sabbath, which is an entertaining chapter in his book for sure, when he toured with Sabbath, that they called, there was a little person who dressed up as the devil that was on the cover of the now kind of iconic cult classic record Born Again by Black Sabbath, that Don Arden, Sharon's father, had hired this little person to come out dressed as the little demon that was on the cover of the Born Again album. Don Arden was apparently 100% responsible for the ridiculous stage show. At least Ian Gillan thought it was kind of silly and ridiculous, that was a part of the Born Again Black Sabbath tour. So, having said that, Ian Gillan says that they were calling the little guy, not necessarily him, but other members of the band, Ronnie, as poking fun at their former lead singer before Gillan, Ronnie James Dio. So I don't know if it made me think, did somebody get their stories crossed in that magazine article that I read a long time ago where they said they were referring to the little person on the Ozzy tour, the Diary of a Madman tour, as Ronnie, or were both Sabbath post-Dio and Ozzy post-Sabbath both referring to the little person as Ronnie? I don't know, just kind of interesting. And on a side note, in Rudy Sarzo's book, the little person who toured with Ozzy during the Diary of a Madman tour was also in the movie Blade Runner, if I remember correctly. So yeah, I thought that was kind of weird. But we know that when Dio originally left Sabbath after Mob Rules, even though, you know, again, there's been a lot of revisionist history, but they were not on good terms. They were not on good terms at all. And what's even more bizarre is, you know, Mob Rules, the great Sabbath record, which I actually just bought the vinyl reissue of that. I guess it's what, the 40-year anniversary? Yeah, 40 years. Yeah, it's, and which is a really highly recommended. But okay, so that, lost my train of thought. Oh, when they toured for Born Again, they weren't playing one song off of that record, which I think is crazy because that record had really just came out 2 years earlier. It was the album before Born Again, not including the live record. So the fact that they were playing zero off of that record goes to show you that really that record kind of got more popular as time went on. I remember getting into that album after seeing Ronnie Dio on a TV special, and I believe he played Mob Rules, and that got me interested in that song and caused me to go back to that record. So Ronnie was playing some Sabbath songs in his set list, but Black Sabbath was barely playing anything. When they toured with Gillan in 83, the only Dio-era Sabbath song they played was Heaven and Hell, which is nuts, right? They also, coincidentally, they did Smoke on the Water, which is kind of interesting, but they had Gillan in the band, so why not, right? And Gillan said that when he originally teamed up with them and the idea came that he was going to work with Iommi and Geezer, that they were going to do a bunch of Deep Purple songs and a bunch of Sabbath songs. It was going to be like a Deep Purple Sabbath hybrid, I don't know, if you will. And that then I got kicked to the side, and it was just Sabbath, and they made Gillan dress a certain way and yada, yada, yada. So yeah, interesting times. So there you go. Just a little Sabbath talk for you, right? Let's get into my interview right now with George Lynch. Man, again, I only got to half my questions with this guy, but nonetheless, it was a great conversation. Big thanks to Sean for hooking it up and to George for talking with me. Let's have a listen right now.
Hey, it's Mark Striegel with Talking Metal, and we are welcoming back to the show Mr. George Lynn. George, how are you, man?
Right now, I'm good. Yesterday was... No, day before yesterday, I had like a little upset stomach thing. But tomorrow's going to be perfect.
All right. And you're out playing some shows right now, right? You in Texas?
Yeah. We're in Texas, and we work our way around here for a little bit. And then we're going to Colorado, and then we're going to do a week in Sturgis, and then back to Texas, and then that's it for a couple of weeks.
Cool. And I do want to talk to you about live shows in a minute, but first let's start off with the new album, which is out August 20th, Seamless, your first instrumental record, which I have to admit, I was surprised to hear that because, I mean, for so long we've associated you with one of the, you know, most popular hard rock instrumental songs, Mr. Scary, but this is your first record of all instrumental, from what I understand. And why is now the time for that after so many years?
Well, it's never the right time for probably just about anything. So the time picked me. I didn't pick it, so to speak, because if I had waited for everything to line up, you know, the stars to align and all that, I would have never done the record. But, in my mind, to do a kind of a, you know, magnum opus masterwork, you know,
right,
with what you're expecting to do and people expect you to do, is requires a lot of time, resources, planning, and, you know, kind of, you know, unique ideas and things like that. So I was thinking, not that this is entirely unique, I mean, there's nothing unique in the world, but I mean, what I was thinking was I would go to a unique location for each song, compose it in that location, be affected by the environment, whatever, you know, a cave in Pakistan, Joshua Tree, go to Rancho Luna, do one, or go out to a, you know, a desert island and record one remotely, I don't know, all that kind of stuff, right? Work with, you know, maybe write with different people and different environments and with different gear. And that's the other thing too, gear that I have, I could have done a gear thing where I just like documented every piece of gear, and like every song was like, you know, was integral to the gear. And so, like, for instance, I have access to like Jimi Hendrix's old amp, or wow, or Stevie Ray's steel string slinger, singer, I'm sorry. And you know, really important guitars and stuff like that, you know, historically significant guitars and all that kind of stuff, you know, to tape or in studios that are renowned and have tons of history, you know, and all that kind of thing. And that's a pretty huge undertaking, you know, and finding the right cats to play with, and all the logistics and the travel, and how are we going to record this? Is it going to be a remote recording? Is it going to be to tape? So we're going to all kinds of different formats, and who's going to engineer all this? And, you know, massive undertaking. What ended up happening was I wrote a record that didn't work out, that was supposed to be just a regular rock record. And I was just sitting on it, and I thought, what am I going to do with this? And the label guy says, well, why don't you try instrumentalizing it? And I thought at first, no, that's dumb. And this stuff wasn't written for that. So, but then I tried it actually over the next couple of weeks, just messing around, and it was actually fun, and it worked for the most part. So I said, you know what, I'll do this. So I did the exact opposite of what I, in my mind, I had thought I would have to do to make an instrumental record. It was sort of more of a happy accident situation.
Right on. And I do want to talk about some of the specific songs off the record. I mean, obviously, I mentioned the song Mr. Scary earlier. Anybody who's coming to this record thinking they're going to get songs that sound like that will be definitely surprised, because it's nowhere close to that. I mean, it opens up with Quiver. And for the first 2 minutes of this song, like I almost get like more of a Tom Morello meets almost like Jeff Beck or something vibe. Can you talk a little bit about that song and coming up with the riffs and the ideas for the song?
I mean, you hit the nail on the head. It was definitely a tribute, if not a rip, of Tom Morello, for sure. You know, I mean, anytime you step on the whammy pedal, you're going to be associated with Tom Morello, because he pretty much owns that space. But that's okay. You know, I love Tom. I love Tom on a, on all kinds of levels, you know, not just his musicianship and his songwriting, but his politics too. I'm a huge friend and a fan. And so I'm feel privileged to be able to channel or emulate him in any way. So that was, yeah, I call that a tribute to Tom, and it's very effective, you know. And he's, you know, kind of does some really tricky things with, you know, effects and guitars that are, you know, I think reproducible and worthy of reproduction, you know.
Absolutely. I
mean, you know, anytime we play any technique, somebody did it before us, you know. Somebody tapped, somebody vibratoed, somebody arpeggiated, you know, somebody economically picked or alternately picked or whatever effect you're using, you know, somebody did it before, even if it was an accident, did it before you did it. So yeah, that's what that was. And then, you know, throughout the record, I mean, I'm, you know, I've never learned any songs or techniques verbatim from anyone. You know, I never sat down with a record and go, oh, I'm going to pick apart how, you know, Eric Clapton played that solo. I can never play anybody's solo note for note, including my own, but I can play in the spirit of, so I sort of absorb by osmosis what they're implying. And then I integrate that into what I'm doing, and I can kind of channel that a little bit. And that's what I am doing probably throughout this, right? My whole guitar life. That's kind of the philosophy of my playing.
Right on. The song, I think, love this, how it starts with that muffled guitar, more distant sound. And then, you know, when it kicks in with the guitars and the band and everything, you can really feel the production of the song and the album at that point. I wanted to ask you about that because I know you produced the record. How does it differ from being a guitar player, songwriter, as to being a producer?
Well, the production credit in this case isn't what I would consider what a producer would, you know, be known for if you're a, you know, a world famous producer, what they do. I mean, when you're a musician in a rock band and you're a guitar player, you're a producer if you're doing records. I mean, if you're worth your salt, you know, you're deciding on sounds, you're deciding on arrangements and compositions, you're making compositional decisions and you're how things are recorded. A lot of times the producers on projects are just the guys that deal with logistics, you know, and the right. engineers would be more responsible for some of that stuff that we just mentioned. So, you know, producer is a pretty broad title. It could mean a lot of things. I've worked with producers that have done virtually nothing in the studio. So in that case, I'm a great producer because I can do nothing very well. No, but I mean, I've got my hands in everything. I mean, it's my record, so I'm dealing with everything from A to Z, soup to nuts, logistics, funding, hiring, you know, band crew and engineers and dealing with the scheduling and all that boring, you know, bookkeeping stuff and housekeeping. And then, you know, running the sessions and keeping track of everything or keeping it organized. You know, there's a lot to do with it behind the scenes, obviously, when you're doing a record. And so that's producing. And then, of course, I'm obviously writing the songs and making the decisions about that and the instrumentation and how things are played and approached and the sound, you know, the tones we're getting and so forth. So, and, you know, mix approvals and sequencing and mastering and all this stuff. I mean, you know, so I guess that's being a producer, I guess.
Yeah, right on. And that song I just mentioned, I Think, which I think is my favorite, no pun intended, off the record. About 3 minutes in, you go into this really trippy kind of, at times beautiful, soundscapey type of thing. Can you talk about that? Are those all guitar sounds? Because at times it almost sounds like I'm hearing vibes or steel drums in there.
Everything was triggered by a guitar.
Wow.
That's the kind of the point of it. Yeah, and I do this whole... All that was actually Jimmy DeAnda and I were initially working together at his studio on writing songs that we thought was going to be an album, you know, a Lynch Mob album or something. And we worked for a few days together. We came up with some ideas and that was one of them. And that whole centerpiece, we just played it. We just came up with it. It wasn't even rehearsed. We hadn't even talked about it. We were just jamming a lot. And that was a whole jam piece that we did that we built on. We just kept that intact. And then we I added all the other parts on my own later, and he came, you know, so it was, I can't exactly remember what I played.
Right. Yeah.
Some, not exactly. Yeah. Kind of in that vein.
And right. I
had done that and some other little bits around it. And then we just, and then I thought, I'm just going to make this, I'm going to orchestrate this and make it dramatic and emotional and, you know, peaks and valleys, and found all kinds of cool effects that did different things, Caribbean steel drums and synthy kind of pedals and Chase Bliss stuff that I use. You know, I like really weird, quirky pedals. You know, Chris, we have all the basics, you know, all of us have, you know, the modulation pedals and the echoes and delays and fuzz and distortion and chorus and, you know, wah-wah pedals, stuff like that. But then, you know, I've got lots of other just weird stuff, and they do one weird thing and that's it. You can never use it twice. Some of it's homemade. Some of it's just like, doesn't have a name on it or just goofy shit or really strange combinations. You know, you get creative with like say a Sustainiac into a whammy pedal, which you pitch up or down, let's say pitch it up into a ring modulator. I'll just throw those three out there. You know what I mean?
Right. Yep.
And with tweaking on that, you can, and the ring modulator, let's say you have a expression pedal mounted on it. So then, wow, now you got two pedals and you got all these controls and you can do, you know, you just go nuts, you know, and that's right. What we did. That's what took the most time. Writing the songs didn't, you know, and even playing the solos didn't take that much time. It was really kind of figuring all that transcendental ear candy layering and stuff that's just takes a lot of experimentation and imagination.
Right on. It's awesome. And again, we're talking with George Lynch. The album is Seamless, Rat Pack Records. It will be out August 20th, guys, so definitely check it out. And do you use Kempers or dial-in amp sounds, or are you pretty traditionally going through like old-school amps?
No Kemper, no. I used just old amps. I got a pretty fun amp set up in my studio that I've had for almost 20 years now, and I've just been fine-tuning it over the years. So I have a switching system where I can switch to any amp on the fly into a common cabinet that's mic'd up with a Royer 121 and usually a second mic, which I may or may not use, which could be 57 or, you know, whatever. Just, you know, typical mics that most guitar players use in studios now. Nothing fancy there. Once in a while, I use a little room, and I've got it usually going through either a basket weave or Marshall, you know, old pre-Rolo Celestion basket weave, or I've got some old high watts that I love too. And I also just recently discovered my a cabinet that I knew I had, but I hadn't thought about it much in recent decades. And I had bought it from Eddie back when he did the Women and Children's first record. And
wow.
And it's the one that's stripped of Tolex. It's just bare wood and has the JBLs and the Celestions in it. JBL D112Fs and I guess pre-roll of 20 watts. And I took the back off it for some reason, me and my tech some months ago, and Eddie had signed the inside of it, and I'd forgotten that. And he put, you know, the Women and Children first tour or record, whatever, signed all that stuff in there. I was like blown away. So now when I play that, I play better because I know it was his, you know?
Wow. That's awesome. And yeah. Do you use that cabinet on Seamless?
I don't think so.
Right. Okay.
I don't think so. But, you know, it's something now that I pretty much centerpiece of my rig. But just cause, you know, whenever you play, you know, that's happened to me too when I've played, venues that have historical significance. Like there's a club, Corazon, I think it's called, in Seattle. And Hendrix stood on that stage and played, and Kurt Cobain. So it's like, I'm standing in the same spot, you gotta fucking, that's gotta be channeling. You gotta be inspired. You know what I mean?
Right on. Yeah.
It's just out of my mind inspired. It's like, holy fuck, you know. Same as you play a big venue, you know, like an arena or something where, or even, you know, even the Whiskey to an extent in Hollywood. I mean, Led Zeppelin played there, you know, Judas Priest played on that stage. It's, I mean, countless people. So,
and you're playing there December 17th and 18th. Do you remember playing there for the first time?
I don't really remember the first Whiskey gig, to be honest. I'm sorry. We played so many clubs back then, you know, it was just constantly playing the Troubadour, the Whiskey, the Starwood, the this and then that, you know, there's like a dozen clubs, but my favorite club to play was always the Starwood. Starwood was like a mini arena. It had that kind of vibe to it, you know, because it was, PA was way overpowered for the room and the room was real tall. You had like kind of upstairs little balcony, almost like, you know, almost like Thunderdome, you know, it was intense.
Awesome. And you will be coming through my neck of the woods November 11th. You're in New Jersey with George Lynch and the Electric Freedom. Dokken also on that bill. Can you talk about the Electric Freedom? Who's in the band and how that came about?
Yeah, it's a power trio, power trip. And it's Michael Devon is playing playing bass and singing, doing all the lead vocals. And Jason Sutter's on drums. And I mean, we're all having a fucking blast because it's just, you know, it's sort of liberating losing the Lynch Mob yoke.
Right.
Because now I'm not restricted in any way as to what I can. The only thing that restricts me at this point is our own capabilities and time, because we haven't had a lot of time to really gel as a band and rehearse. We've had a few rehearsals, but not enough to really go deep and, you know, kind of discover who we are. So we're in this kind of amorphous process of becoming who we are. And I love it. I love it because every show is different. It's like a snowflake, you know, it's like, before I called you, I'm sitting here in my hotel room and I was just screwing around and I thought, oh, you know, this is a cool riff. So I just texted the guys. I made a little recording of it. I texted to them. I go, let's mess with this tonight. You know,
right on.
Let's open up the show. Don't have an opening tape. Cause that's, you know, your intro tape, you know, it's like this false grandiosity, you know, but here they are, you know, flying down from the heavens with their angel wings and smoke machines. And, you know, I just, how about we just walk out there and just fucking blow people's wet minds and play something, just make up something, you know, and without a safety net, you know, and I love that idea. So that's what we can do that in this band. And we do it. We jam a lot. We do, you know, our own version of covers that could change from night to night. And of course we do Lynch Mob stuff as well. And occasionally Dokken stuff and do Mr. Scary, you know, do all that. We try to do a balance of, we give people what they want. And then we try to challenge them a little bit and ourselves too at the same time.
Right on. And how has the vibe been out there with live concerts? Obviously we're hearing about this variant, the Delta variant, and is it feel safe and good out there on stage?
Well, I'm very conflicted and I'm a supreme hypocrite because I'm, you know, safety guy, you know, I'm double vaxxed and don't wear my mask everywhere. And I'm real careful about travel and anything like that. But I care about other people. And yet again, I play shows where I afford the opportunity for people to stand shoulder to shoulder without masks on and get sick. So I'm not sure how to deal with that because, you know, it was really, as you know, things were tamped down quite nicely. And it looks like things were going sort of back to semi-normal there for a second.
Yeah.
And that's when we booked all these shows. And now I'm contractually obligated to play these shows and, you know, paid for flights and paid for everything. You know, it's like, I mean, literally if I pulled out of this 2-week run, whatever else I got contracted for, I'd get my ass sued, I'd get blackballed and, you know, I'd just be out of the business. It still doesn't make it right. So I try to make it as safe as possible. I cannot control what people do. Hopefully everybody is masked up. And that's what I encourage people to do, is mask up. and try to stay distant. Obviously, right. You know, we play mostly outside venues. I mean, on this run, we're playing one indoor venue in Houston, but it's a large, you know, amphitheater. It's tricky. Yeah, it's a crazy time right now. You know, I do understand music is important. It's a vital thing, just like food, air, water, and love. I mean, it's all that too. I mean, we need it, you know, for our sanity and our humanness to be social creatures. You know, we can't, but it's, we got to be smart at the same time and follow the science and do the right thing. So it is exasperating, frustrating to see people push back against that. And very disappointing to see people do that, because I mean, if we had all done collectively the right thing and done our duty, we're not getting shots of little government's not putting cameras in our bodies or anything.
Yeah, right.
That's why we don't have polio anymore. Let's just do that, you know, and we can get through this and get back to some semi-normalcy.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. I mean, I went out and bought all these tickets for these shows coming up, you know, including one at Madison Square Garden in like 2 weeks. And now I'm like thinking, I don't know. I just don't know. So,
yeah. I would say at least double mask and don't touch anybody.
Right on.
I mean, with this new virus, with this new strain, they say it's, you know, it's just like cigarette smoke. I mean, that's transmittable, more transmittable than chickenpox. So I'd say no.
Right.
I know what's going to get to people is when businesses, you know, since we don't have this kind of, you know, we're not like some countries where people are sort of a hive society and they work together collectively for the common good. We're this country of rugged, supposed individualists that don't need anybody else's help. And so we're all those independent people and operate that way to some extent. So, but the way the things will change is through business, because businesses' job is to make money, and you don't make money by killing your customers. So you know, they'll force, you know, vaccine card mandates and all these kinds of things. And then that'll happen, you know, to go to work and to go to a venue or get on a transportation, or I don't know what, you know, work at a hospital. And I think that'll be the new normal, and it should be, you know, nothing wrong with that.
Right on.
I mean, I don't see anybody crying about seatbelts, but I remember they used to when they had a seatbelt mandate and everybody, that's seatbelts taking away my freedom. And seatbelts was just you. That wasn't affecting anybody else. This is even way more of a issue where, you know, not only are you going to potentially hurt yourself, but you're going to hurt a whole bunch of other people too, including people you love potentially. So, you know, I mean, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but.
Right. Right. No, I'm with you 100%. Yeah. Well, I will say that the show I'm going to at the Garden, it was billed as vaccinated only, and you have to bring your vaccination card. So we'll see.
That good start, although it can be obviously counterfeited very easily.
Yes, that is true. Anyways, George, it is 101. I know we have to wrap it up, so let's just remind people, Seamless by George Lynch, out August 20th. Great stuff, really, George. Really enjoying the record, and can't wait for people to hear the whole album. I know there's a single out now, but the whole album coming on August 20th.
Yeah, Death by a Thousand Licks is this, I hate to call it a single. I mean, it's just this kind of afterthought. It's two parts, me, Brian Tichy, just going off. And it's just a vehicle for pure guitar insanity. I just go, okay, I'm going to play the craziest shit I can think of or not think. And that's what I did. So,
right on.
I don't know if you can call it a single.
Right. First release off the record. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Thanks, George. Be well. We'll see you November 11th in New Jersey.
Take care.
Okay, bye. George Lynch has a new record out on August 20th. It's called Seamless. It is good. I'm not lying to you. It's good. You know, the first single George corrected me. It's not a single. The first song released off the album, I have to admit, is one of my least favorite on the record, because there are some awesome, awesome songs on this record. And I feel like the groove and even the melodies on some of the other songs are a little stronger. Not that that song's
bad, but just know if you hear that song and you're like, yeah, it's all right, that there are some monster songs on this record. Cola is a great tune. I Think, which I mentioned to George, Falling Apart, which closes the record. Supersonic Hypnotic Groove Thing, which is like UFO meets Joe Satriani meets, like, you know, I don't know, like modern day Lynch. It's really solid. That's probably the closest one you get to a straight ahead rocker on the album, Supersonic Hypnotic Groove Thing. But definitely a great listen, and didn't get to ask him about seeing him 35 years ago, almost to the day, on the Fuel for Life tour with Judas Priest. That was when Dokken opened up for Judas Priest. Wanted to ask him about that. No time. Wanted to ask him about his work with Corey Glover in Ultraphonics. Corey Glover, of course, from Living Color fame. A lot of questions I didn't get to. But anyways, the Dokken box set that Pilsen mentioned recently, I wanted to ask him about that. But no time. So we'll have to get back with George soon. And that, I believe, this was like my fifth time interviewing George. And I had three great interviews with him. The fourth one I felt like was a disaster. That was an in-person one with him, Robert Mason, and Scott Coogan. And it was just off the rails. And George didn't seem in the best of moods that day. But this made up for it. I felt like we had a great conversation today, and I appreciated his time, and I appreciate his new music. I appreciate you for listening to this. I did want to mention a couple Twitter polls before we log off here. I threw out there on the Twitter, which is at talkingmetal.com, a couple polls. So let's see how these are doing. These polls haven't actually closed yet, so these aren't final results. I suppose I should be waiting for the final results before I announce them on my podcast. But the first poll I did was, which classic commercial hard rock band is your favorite? The choices were Dokken, Rat, Poison, Quiet Riot. Well, I guess this isn't too surprising since they sold a lot of records, but Poison squeaking it out with 30%, Rat at 29%, Dokken at 23%, Quiet Riot at 18% with still 5 hours to go. By the time I post this podcast, it'll probably be about 1 hour to go, but you can go vote on that. The other question I asked was, when will you feel comfortable attending a packed indoor concert? Arena concert, not club concert. When will you feel comfortable attending a packed indoor arena concert? The choices were months ago, now, this fall, sometime in 2022. So I found this surprising, guys, but I guess with the Delta variant, it shouldn't be. 51% said they're, you know, out of 70 people voting, that they aren't going to be ready for concerts in a packed arena until 2022. Wow. That is nuts. Or maybe it's not. I don't know. I'm so confused by this COVID stuff at this point. So 13% they said they were ready months ago. 26% say they're ready now. I guess that would kind of be me, although now I'm starting to scratch my head a little bit. 10% said this fall, and again 51% said sometime in 2022. I appreciate you guys taking time to vote in my polls. I really, really appreciate everyone who supports me on Patreon. I have all size t-shirts in now, from small to triple L. So you big guys out there, you know, join me on Patreon for $5 a month, you get a t-shirt. Same for you little guys and medium sized guys. Everyone, we have all the sizes you need on Patreon. You got to do $5 a month for that. All right. Thanks again, guys. And again, support our sponsors that you hear at the beginning of each podcast. I don't make a ton of money off of those, but they do help with my hosting fees that I get those ads through Art19, and they also do my hosting for the podcast. A great company, Art19. Really appreciate everything they do for me. They don't work with a lot of independent people like myself, so I feel fortunate to have those guys on my team and on my side. We'll talk to you later. Thank you to everyone for listening.